Nina van Tolberg for Buzz News. As South Africans are increasingly faced with load shedding, potholes, and the deterioration of so many services, the penny has dropped for many that it's no use waiting for the government to fix it. In his New Year's message, Gift of the Givers, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman said he believed that fixing the country did not belong to the government, it belonged to all of us. Well, this is exactly what South Africans are doing as they start providing their own electricity and communities are coming together to fix potholes and clean streets. Frans Rotenbach, a Labour lawyer from Cape Town, believes that the process of helping ourselves can be taken a step further. And he has written a book titled Help Yourself South Africa. And I have Frans in the BizNews studio with me. Hi Frans, welcome to BizNews.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've read your book and your suggestions are extensive. It's basically, if I can summarize it, a blueprint for reforming the economy. I need you to start us off by explaining where do all your ideas come from?
I needed to find a way to persuade people to change the economic system. Firstly, the voters. And I stumbled on the idea that there is no better teacher than experience. People are not persuaded by rational argument, and least of all, our government. So that was the nub of the genesis, if you like, of the book.
Okay, let's get into what you want to change. It's basically, from a political science point of view, which is my background, rolling back the state and allowing citizens to do more for themselves. And you want to reform literally everything, from education, agriculture, healthcare, manufacturing, housing, and labor law. And you even suggest a new currency called the Claims Guarantee. Take us through that.
Yes, you're quite right. The focus of the reform is to roll back the power of the state. Just to give a little bit of structure, in the first five chapters, I stake out my claim, as it were, my argument as to what we should aim for. It's no good you say to people, we must change the economy, but you don't tell them why and what you are aiming for. So that's the first part, is what do we aim for? What is wrong with the patient? So we diagnose the disease, and then we can start reforming. And I deal with main topics of value, money, the merit principle, which features very strongly. I feel we drifted into the opposite in South Africa. And then I look at the legal system, court system, corruption. One cannot do anything in South Africa without dealing with corruption. So those are the basic problems and then the basic principles to address those problems, but not on a how basis, but simply what must change. So the second half of the book then deals with how do we change. And I thought of a very powerful model for change, which we saw in China in the 80s, when Deng Xiaoping had to change in desperation to a more market-oriented economy. And he decided, well, I'm going to test the waters and created places like Shanghai, which are effectively free market zones. And those are were so powerful that people then clamored, they wanted to become part of that system. So that's the thinking. But now you can't ask our government to put up a free market zone. It will laugh you out of court because that will show up its own faults and it will lose initiative. And it goes against the instinct. If you're a statist organization like our government is, and most governments, in fact, end up favoring government, central government power, then you won't just consent. So I needed to find another way, and that other way is to create, by private agreement, little pilot projects for all the areas of reform which you've already started mentioning. And those will then demonstrate, show, rather than tell, the benefits of a free market.
Well, let's take them one by one. How would you transform education?
Okay, education, I've done research. There is no question that private, decentralized private education is far superior, both in terms of cost, ultimately in terms of value for money, and in terms of efficiency. One of the arguments that I give in the merit part of the book is Macau, which is now 97% private education and is one of the very top educational achievers in the world. So there's no question that you're going to have good quality education if you have private education, but it can also be done cheaply. So the experiment is you create a budget of 20,000 Rand per learner, which is what the government pays at the moment. And you give that to a private entrepreneur. You say, for 20,000 Rand per child per year, build us a school, run the school, and then let's tot up the totals. Let's see who does best. So that's a demonstration model. And then at a later stage, my suggestion is that employers should come to the party. But the same principle, 20,000 Rand ahead. And my suggestion there is that instead of having this employment equity system that we have, let's rather focus on schools. In fact, I've now covered two of them.
And healthcare, that's more of a difficult one because, you know.
Yeah, healthcare is, of course, disastrous. I start this story with healthcare by comparing the COVID results in the plus minus first 6 months of the pandemic, comparing private dominated countries and national health system countries. And I was shocked to find that Britain, for example, had almost 10 times the rate of fatalities that those countries which had private dominated. So there's no question about the superiority. The other surprise was I found that 41% of South Africa, despite our poverty and despite our unemployment, 41% of our citizens make use of private medical care. So that is quite a remarkable thing. So the value of private medical care is recognized, but you must find a way to get employers to help employees to get private medical care. At the moment, a small minority of employers provide a medical scheme. But the problem with the medical scheme is that the act and legislation is so restrictive that it is not cost effective for ordinary people. So besides, of course, addressing employment, we must double employment, and that's a separate topic. But once we start doing that, salaries will go up, benefits will improve, and employers will be able, by designing benefit for their employees whereby they, the employer, buy the medical service, they will get much cheaper medical aid. So it's not a medical scheme. That's the important thing. And you will find that's a theme in the book. You look at where does the regulation stymie us? Where does it shackle us? And then you find a way to work around that. So that is what we do there. We design the scheme such that it does not get defined as a medical scheme.
Well, all of these are so far away from where the government is, especially if you look at the new plans for a national health insurance. The government's idea is to centralize most of the functions you are addressing. I think the closest to what you are proposing is in electricity generation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that the penny is dropping finally, but many people didn't realize when in 2020, the president made a speech and he said, we finally want private people to generate their own electricity. What they did was they created an opening in the act, not the act, in the schedule to the act, in terms of which it is okay to generate electricity on an unlimited scale as long as you're not connected to the grid. And that can be organized. You don't have to be part of a grid. And my interpretation of that is, you know, the sky's the limit.
Right. But you're also suggesting reforms to labor legislation. This is actually what you do. You're a labor lawyer, aren't you?
I started out as a labor lawyer. And then I realized that if you really want to create employment, you have to look at various areas.
Okay. Are you also suggesting that labor legislation and black empowerment could be challenged constitutionally?
Yes. I've looked at all the aspects of employment, and you have the Labor Relations Act, and that's a separate topic in the book. And there are three aspects to that. There's a challenge, a constitutional challenge, which will really emasculate the act, and I believe it's at least arguable. It depends on the judge that you find on the day. employment equity, same thing there. I think it can be challenged under the constitution. But apart from that, even if we fail and we don't go to court successfully, we can then create by private agreement, which is the main model, and which are private agreements. You can, for example, employment equity, I touched on it earlier. Most people think you have to have demographic population of various layers of your employment in the company. That's not necessary. What you can do is you can say, I'll give preference to black pupils in a school funded by the employer. And that can be your model. And I think that's the way to go, because everybody agrees that we desperately need education. And in fact, that's the main reason why employment equity doesn't work and is discredited, because you need human capital. You need intellectual capital if you want to promote people to managers and CEOs and directors and that kind of thing. So that's the private equity part. And then I also have some suggestions for agreements on the ordinary employment contract side.
Your suggestions go quite far. You even suggest a new currency for South Africa.
Yes.
Explain that to us.
Yes, I'll try my utmost. Everybody knows that the world is going a little bit out of kilter with regard to money creation and inflation. Even the Americans, who thought that they had everything under control, have had increasing inflation, and we've seen the central banks clamping down, and there's huge instability. And that has led to a massive loss over the last few decades of productivity, because people don't invest in factories and training and technology and all those nice things that make productivity work. They buy shares on the stock exchange. So the result is that all the rich people get beautifully rich on growing stock values, and the rest of us, the normal people who earn salaries or payments for contract work, they get to suck the hind tit. So it's a little bit sad. And I thought of a way that you can escape that cycle. Now, I admit that this is probably the most ambitious and most controversial area of the suggestions, not from a political point of view, but from a sheer practical and economic point of view. It's going to be a difficult thing to make work. But what I want to see is change in the mindset of how people think about money. Money is not something in itself. You can't eat money. People think you can eat money because we're so used to, especially the government paying. They create the stuff, they print it, and then they pay people. They pay people grants in South Africa, they buy them free housing, and they build up mountains and mountains of government debt in the process. Now, all of this creates a weakening currency and contributes to the weakness of the economy and the productivity of the economy. So what you want is to escape that. And I thought, well, we have markets. We had markets in the old days where people swapped. They came to the market and you swap your sheep for a pile of bricks and you build a house. But that's not practical in the modern world. So we invented money. So money is really just something that stands for that wealth. It's just a placeholder, if you like, a message to say, there is so much wealth. I have so much wealth which I want to swap. But it is an undivided share in the total wealth in the economy. That's what it should be. You want to swap wealth for wealth, value for value. You don't want to have something which is a commodity which can grow in quantity and then become watered down, as we've seen with inflation. So conceptually, that's what it boils down to.
Do you want that to replace the rand? And is that in any way possible? It sounds quite far-fetched, if I may say so.
I would think, obviously, you're not going to replace the rand tomorrow. What you want is to create an economy that is built on value creation, first of all, which will necessarily, I suspect, work with the rand economy to start with. If you have a housing project, there's no way in the world you can immediately start trading workers, labor and bricks and mortar and land for claims. What you will do is you do that in the rand denominated economy, and as soon as those systems start becoming up and running. In other words, then your housing system starts working, your employment equity starts working, your health system starts working, and so on. You create these little pockets of productivity which can serve as examples. Those may then provide the impetus. But ultimately, you're going to have somewhere along the line, going to need a leap of faith. And I see that as coming from what we have in South Africa is a very, very wealthy, a healthy, I should say, retail sector, a powerful retail sector. And somehow we got it right in South Africa. And I think they are experts in selling things. And what you need is a market. And I'm talking about a retail market. You need things to be bought and sold electronically. Think Takealot, Amazon, something like that, on which you can then trade with claims. But that is the area where I think they can germinate something like that. But it will have to start small and expand regularly. You don't just announce that the claim is replacing the rand tomorrow.
Frans, what do you hope to achieve by this book? Do you want to start a conversation? Do you want somebody to go and build a model dorpie somewhere that looks like that? What do you hope to achieve?
Ultimately, I would like to build a model dorpie. I think it's important that we create something on the ground, that it's not just an academic idea. I fundamentally aim my message at businesses, entrepreneurs, and I want those who are already engaged in the various areas. If you're into housing, affordable housing, if you're into education, if you're into power generation, whatever your field of expertise is, I would like to talk to those people, and I would like to see if one can start small, persuade people to invest money in something from which they will ultimately make more profit than they're making at the moment. That's what makes this different from the normal NGO who goes cap in hand and asks for corporate money only to spend it on people who then go and spend it somewhere else. What we say is we put up businesses and we can make investors make money. That's the way to do it. Otherwise, it's not self-sustaining.
So how do you want to do that? How do you make money out of these suggestions that you talked about?
Well, take the simple one. One of my favorites is housing. We all know that ever since the government has started building housing for free, the homeless people in South Africa have just shot up in number. So how does one counter that? Now, it's a hugely inefficient system. The government employs contractors who all work under the laws of labor law, which is hugely inefficient. If you work under labor law as an employee, your incentive is to work as long as possible, to build the house for as long as possible. What I say is like the homestead pioneers of old, what we should do is incentivize and empower ordinary homeless people to build their own houses. There's something wrong with this idea that the government has to build a house using employed people and then hand it over for free to people who have done nothing to get the house. If you can find a way, and there are cost-effective ways for unschooled people to build houses, but they can't under the current labor laws because it's too expensive. So my idea is take them outside the arena of employment. So immediately employment law does not apply. Immediately it is cheaper. And the employee, who or the worker, I should say, then build his own house. In partnerships of, say, 20, they build a whole living estate. And those are divided up between the entrepreneur who funds it and organizes it and each of the workers. They get the house. And you can imagine the difference is night and day. If you build your own house, A, you're going to build as fast as possible because you want to move in, and B, you want to have the best quality possible. So the incentive is turned on its head completely. Now, what I'm saying, how do you make money? Somebody comes and puts up the just a normal, there are hundreds of construction entrepreneurs out there who build the affordable housing. They put up the money, they get the land, They get the materials, they get the zoning rights, they do everything. And they and the workers, if you like to call them, the homeless workers, build the houses. And because of the structural difference, it will be far more profitable for that entrepreneur than any other model.
Frans, you mentioned the word pie in the sky. Have you bounced your ideas on economists or political scientists? Because, you know, you cover quite a wide field. Aren't you afraid that somebody might say, but many of these ideas are pie in the sky and are just not going to work in South Africa?
I'm quite willing for that to happen, and I want them to take me on, because what I've said in the book is that these are just suggestions, and I'm hoping that experts would come to the table. I make the point that I can't do it alone, but this is my contribution. This is what I put on the table. Fundamentally, a concept of self-help, which will then branch out into different applications. On some of those, I have quite a bit of experience and confidence. When it comes to the labor law side of things, when it comes to the employment equity side of things, I have done some of those. So I'm confident that I can make those contracts work, or I can make that litigation that I envisage work. In other areas, I readily concede I'm not an expert, and I'm inviting people to come along. Housing experts, health experts, electricity engineers. So it's a spark.
Well, thank you, Frans Rodenburg. Thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
I'm Lena van Tolberg for BizNews.com.